Paradise Radio for the Seeker.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for spending some of your time with us today. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Ice Radio with headquarters in the land of the Goths, the cradle of what today is known as Sweden. Our website is redicecreations.com, and you can follow us worldwide. A new program three times per week, and Radio 314 is every other Wednesday. Today we're talking with Graham Hancock, a best-selling author and more recently a novelist. Fingerprints of the Gods and Talisman are just a few of his excellent titles on the origin of civilization and the conspiracy of a secret religion that rules the world. Today, however, we are going to primarily discuss his latest historical novel, War God, about the Spanish conquest of Mexico and many of the historical characters involved in this turning point in history, as Graham argues. We'll get into some fascinating aspects of what might have been behind the motivation of both the two main characters of this drama, Cortés and Moctezuma, and potentially why things turned out the way they did. It's always a pleasure to be able to speak with you, Graham. I know how busy you are, and we very much appreciate you taking some time off talking with us today. So welcome back, Graham.
Thank you. It's a delight to be back with you.
Excellent. Now, I have a lot of things I want to talk with you about here today during our two segments, but why don't we begin to talk about your latest, a historical novel. It's called War God, so it's a bit different from Entangled that we talked about last time you were with us, Graham, but yeah. Tell us a little bit what is at the heart of this most recent story in terms of the Spanish conquest of Mexico.
Yes, well, War God is my second novel. I think it's fair to say that I'm by far best known as a writer of nonfiction. But I felt a strong calling to exercise such narrative gifts as I have in other directions in recent years. It hasn't meant that I've given up writing nonfiction. Quite the contrary. I have a big sequel to my best-known book, Fingerprints of the Gods, that I'm going to be delivering to the publishers at the end of 2014 for publication in 2015. But I've been going down this parallel track of writing novels, and the reason for that is partly because I don't just want to keep on doing the same thing. I want to keep myself fresh as a writer, and I want to explore other creative avenues, but also because in fictional stories it is possible to explore extraordinary ideas without all the architecture of footnotes and defensive argument that you need to go into in nonfiction. And the particular extraordinary idea that I'm interested in writing a novel about the Spanish conquest of Mexico is the possibility of spiritual forces at work behind history. Demons, in other words. Yep. Now, you try to write a nonfiction book about that, and you're going to run into trouble with the footnotes pretty quickly.
Right.
part of the justification for doing it is that both the Spanish and the Aztecs in the 16th century were people who deeply believed in the supernatural. Aztec society has rightly been described as the last magical civilization. But the Spanish were not so different. Supernatural forces played a hugely important role in their lives. Now, it would be the view of modern scholars that that's all just superstition and folly and childish fancy on the part of the people of those times. But I think we have to consider that the nature of reality may be much more complicated than materialist scientists of the 21st century believe. After all, our science, although it's incredibly clever and very, very effective in the realm of technology, our science is a relatively recent invention of the human creature.
Yeah.
And it sometimes becomes over arrogant and domineering and convinced that its worldview is the only worldview. And one thing that my experiences in the last decade have taught me is that reality is incredibly mysterious and complicated. I really believe that. I think it's a great mystery to be alive at all, to live in a human body, to go through this life, to have the experiences that we have, to make daily choices between dark and light, between good and evil, sometimes at a small scale, sometimes at a very large scale. And I'm open to the possibility that we are immersed in an unseen realm, which influences us in many ways that we may not be aware of. And my last nonfiction book, which was called Supernatural, and looked into shamanism and altered states of consciousness. In researching that book, as I think we've discussed before, I had the experience, and I've continued to have the experience, of drinking ayahuasca, the vine of souls, the vine of the dead that is used by shamanistic cultures in the Amazon jungle and has been used for thousands of years. And in the ayahuasca experience, it's very common to, and I have done so many times myself, to encounter what appear to be intelligent entities that communicate with you. And sometimes they communicate in a positive way, but sometimes they can seem very, very threatening and dangerous as well. And we just don't know what these entities are. Are they simply projections of our own minds? I'm perfectly open to that possibility. But or is it possible that what the ayahuasca is doing, what the DMT, the dimethyltryptamine in the ayahuasca is doing, is in some way altering the receiver wavelength of our brain and allowing us to gain access to other levels of reality, which are normally closed off to our senses? And that's certainly what shamans believe. They believe on the ayahuasca journey that they enter into the spirit world and that the entities they encounter are spirits. And some of them are benign, and some of them are malignant. And so this is what I wanted to explore when I wrote War God, the subtitle of which is The Knights of the Witch, and which is about the Spanish conquest of Mexico, because it's a fact of history that Moctezuma, the Aztec emperor of that time, like his predecessors, was in daily contact with the entity who he believed was their war god, whose name was Huitzilopochtli, which means, in shorthand, hummingbird, hummingbird at the left hand of the sun.
Yeah.
And Moctezuma had his encounters with hummingbird after consuming psilocybin mushrooms. The psilocybin mushrooms were called Teonanactil in Aztec culture, and that means the flesh of the gods. And they were used to bring about a trance state with which contact with the spirit world became possible. And I think it's well known, and probably many of your listeners who are familiar with my work know this, that I'm a big supporter of psychedelics used responsibly. And I believe it is the sovereign right of all adults to make choices as to their own consciousness and whether they wish to have the psychedelic experience or not.
Yeah.
But it would be wrong to say that psychedelics are all sweetness and light and that that everything is rosy in the garden.
Right.
because psychedelics have been used by some cultures, and the Aztecs were one of them, for truly demonic behavior and contacts, and perhaps it's the state of mind that you bring to the psychedelic experience, which influences the entities that you invite in. But it's very clear in the case of Moctezuma that his encounters with this demonic entity, the war god Hummingbird, led him to carry out the most horrific acts of evil and violence. He was not the first of the Aztec emperors to do this. There had been many before. But what they did was they preyed on neighboring people. They were a huge militaristic power, the Aztecs. By the way, we should properly call the Aztecs the Mexica, That's right. That's their correct name. But I'm going to continue to use the word Aztec because that is the one that's most often used in general parlance today. In the book, I do refer to them as the Mexica, from which we get the name Mexico, by the way.
Right.
The Aztecs were a militaristic power. They were newcomers on the scene. They had arrived as a wandering tribe in the Valley of Mexico in the early 1300s. Initially, they were despised, very poor, without resources, had to work as servants for the other tribes who lived in that area. But they had this powerful will. And this kind of seething, burning hatred and envy of others, and they raised themselves up by military force. They one by one began to dominate all of their neighbors until within 50 or 60 years of their arrival in the Valley of Mexico, they were the rulers of the Valley of Mexico, and then began the Aztec Empire. And it grew and grew, and they made neighboring peoples their vassals who paid tribute to them. And that tribute involved handing over young men and women to be sacrificed on the altar of Huitzilopochtli, to be marched up the pyramid and to have their hearts cut out in this ghastly ritual of serial killing, which Aztec society celebrated and relished.
Yeah.
And this went on for the next 200 years. And when we come to 1519, the year that the Spanish turn up on the coast of Mexico, the Aztec Empire is in absolute control of almost the whole of Mexico. They have not extended their power into the realms of the Maya very far, but the whole of the central part of Mexico is completely under Aztec control. And they are bullying and terrorizing all of their neighbors. And there is a neighboring people called the Tlaxcalans who managed to maintain their independence, who the Aztecs fought wars with every year. And those were called the Flowery Wars. And they were carried, they always used these ridiculous euphemisms for murder, you know, flowery war. But it actually meant it was wars to take human sacrifices, to take victims for human sacrifice, who they would then march up there. First of all, they would fatten them in fattening pens so that they would be delicious and desirable for the god. Yes. And then they would march them up the pyramid, cut out their hearts, throw the hearts on a brazier, and then slice off the arms and legs and head of the poor victim. The head was spitted on a skull rack along with hundreds of other such heads. The arms and legs were eaten with chilies and beans, and the rest of the body was thrown down the steps and fed to the wild animals in Moctezuma's zoo. And all of this was in honor of this hideous entity called Huitzilopochtli, hummingbird, who Moctezuma, as I said, regularly encountered in visionary states and who constantly urged Moctezuma on to more and more acts of horror and violence. Now, again, a modern psychologist would say, well, Moctezuma was just a schizophrenic and unfortunately happened to run a country. And this was just his hallucination. But I want to, this is what I can do in fiction. I can explore the possibility that these visionary encounters had some reality to them, that there is a spirit world, that there are entities inhabiting that spirit realm, which play with human beings, that there are, if you like, angels and demons,
yeah.
That there is a struggle for between good and evil in the universe, and that human beings are the focus of that. And in the case of the Aztecs, an evil demonic force had taken control of them and turned them into this murderous power. I mean, I would say, you know, if you imagine a society that was organized by and in the interests of a group of the worst serial killers in history, that would be Aztec society. I refuse to whitewash the Aztecs. There's a politically correct movement that wants to say, oh, they didn't really do that much human sacrifice.
Right. Yeah.
And it was all mainly symbolic. Absolute nonsense as far as I'm concerned. I've read the accounts of the time. I've studied it in depth, and they were just murderous killers. That's what they were, and I will not excuse them for that in any way.
Yep.
Now, on the other side, we have, this is why the story is really so fascinating to me, we have the Spanish, and the Spanish are also murderous killers. Spain in 1519, not many years before, just in 1492, they had completed what is called the Reconquista. They had reconquered Spain from the Moors. The Islam had held large areas of Spain for 700 years. And the indigenous Spanish, the Castilians, Aragonese, and others had gradually driven them out of Spain. And that driving of the Moors out of Spain was completed in 1492, the very year that Columbus crossed the Atlantic and first of all, supposedly, discovered the New World. So the Spanish were, following the expedition of Columbus, the Spanish were, first of all, intensely militaristic people who had been fighting 700 years of holy war, as far as they were concerned, in the name of their God. And secondly, they were just greedy for gold and wealth. And that's what they went to the New World for. And they settled first on the islands of that we know today as Cuba, and then Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which were then formed, which were then called Hispaniola. So Cuba and Hispaniola. And there they remained for the next 20 or 30 years. They were aware that there was a mainland, but they weren't ready to go for it yet. They didn't feel they had the forces. They weren't sure exactly what was going to be waiting them on the mainland. So first of all, the Spanish concentrated on the complete annihilation of the indigenous populations of Cuba and Hispaniola, who were called the Taino Indians. And a genocide was carried out on those islands, a really grotesque genocide, horrible murders, a complete wiping out of the indigenous population and their replacement by the Spanish. The Spanish used dogs as a weapon of war, and they would feed the Taino Indians to their dogs. They would also cut off the arms and legs of captives just to see whether their Toledo steel blades were up to it or not. Sometimes they would even dress captives up in armor and spit them on a Toledo steel blade to see if the blade could pierce armor. They kind of experiment. They had absolutely no human compassion for the indigenous inhabitants at all. They were, you know, really, really very brutal, hard-hearted people. And they had no concept that it was actually wrong to take somebody else's country. From their point of view, if you had the power, if you had the might, that's what you did. So right. they took Cuba and Hispaniola, and then in around about from about 1517 onwards, they started sending out very small expeditions towards the mainland, just two or three ships. And one of these expeditions, led by a man called Hernandez de Cordoba, had a battle with the Maya in the Yucatan. He went there with 100 men, and the Maya Maya did not appreciate the arrival of the Spanish on their coast, especially since the Spanish immediately tried to convert them to Christianity. And there was a battle, and Hernandez de Cordoba was badly defeated, and 70 of his men were killed, and they barely had enough men to sail the two or three ships that they had back to Cuba. And then the next expedition to be organized, cutting a long story a little bit short, was the expedition of Hernan Cortez, the famous conquistador, Hernando Cortez, the expedition that sailed in 1519 to the coast of Mexico. And Cortez is a fascinating character. And one of the things I quickly discovered about him, which was how I was able to put these pieces together, was that he also, like Moctezuma, had visionary encounters. The visionary encounters of Cortez took place in dreams, and they were with an entity that he believed was Saint Peter,
right?
His patron saint, who Cortez nearly died in his childhood, and his nurse made an appeal to Saint Peter, and Cortez was miraculously saved. And ever since then, he felt that Saint Peter had a special relationship with him. So he had these dreams of Saint Peter, which I describe in the novel, and in these dreams, Saint Peter urges him on to the conquest and to acts of horrendous violence. So, to give away a little bit of the plot, what I'm suggesting in War God is that the exact same demon who appears to Moctezuma in the disguise of Hummingbird, the War God of the Aztecs, takes another disguise and appears as Saint Peter to Cortez and plays these two men like puppets to do what demons have always done throughout human history, which is to multiply and magnify human misery. And that undoubtedly is what happened with the Spanish conquest of Mexico. You know, their population of Mexico was 30 million people in 1519. Just 50 years after the Spanish conquest, that population had fallen to 1 million people.
Down to one, yeah.
It was a genocide of 29 million. A lot of it caused by introduced diseases, but a lot of it caused by plain murder as well. So this was an event, the Spanish conquest of Mexico. We don't think about it enough today. It shaped the world in which we live. All of the ills and errors of the modern world, in their own way, descend from the events of the Spanish conquest of Mexico. So if demonic intervention was involved, it wasn't just confined to that time. It multiplies out down the range of time into the modern world and infects and continues to infect the world today, because just 20 years after the Spanish conquest of Mexico, less than 20 years, Pizarro went off following exactly the same model and conquered Peru. The entire genocide of the Native American population of North America followed from that model. The whole of the colonial era, slavery, everything, the shape of the world took shape following the events of the Spanish conquest of Mexico. How different it could have been if those two cultures had met each other with respect, sought to learn from one another instead of to enter into mutual slaughter. And better still, if Moctezuma and the Aztecs had been a different people, if they had behaved towards their neighbors with love and with friendship rather than terrorizing them, Cortes would never have been able to pull off the conquest. The only reason he was able to pull off the conquest was because Moctezuma's neighbors hated him so much that quite soon, within a few months, Cortes had managed to get himself about 100,000 local auxiliaries who were fighting for him to overthrow the Aztecs. Right. And so I believe a great responsibility rested on the shoulders of Moctezuma, and he failed that responsibility. And the whole modern world took shape as a result of his failure. So it's a fascinating episode to inquire into, and I thought, you know, the way to deal with this is to write it as a novel and get inside the heads of those characters and explore these demons and what they are. And indeed, the demon is a central character in the novel.
Well, there are many nuances here and historical clues, just as you say, that the background here is historic, and to fill in the gaps, you've created, you know, a few characters to get the reader closer to the story, closer to the history as well. But yet it feels like, Graham, when I'm reading about the book and what you're saying, that you're also trying to find something that explains this extraordinary historical event of murder and genocide, and finding something else that must be driving it, that it cannot solely be in the hands of human beings. That's how you're feeling, right? So something must be behind Moctezuma and Cortes. There just has to be something supernatural.
There doesn't have to be, but I think it's an interesting possibility to inquire into, and one can inquire into it in a world of in a novel of fantasy and fiction much better than you can in a non-fiction book. You know, this is one of the reasons for writing this as a novel. You can really bring this possibility. I insist it's only a possibility. I'm not saying it's a fact. Mm. To life, that we are immersed in this invisible realm that influences us whether we like it or not. That's what all shamans everywhere believe anyway, and they believe it's very important to deal proactively with the spirit world and not to be the victim of the spirit world. So my suggestion is, yes, reality is much more complicated than we imagine, and that our five senses are not enough, and that in altered states of consciousness, we gain direct conscious access to other realms and levels of existence, and those realms and levels have an influence upon us. Now, back of all of this is, I suppose, Gnosticism, this ancient system of ideas that perhaps was at the origin of Christianity, but was very quickly victimized and persecuted by mainstream Christianity. The Gnostic dualistic notion of the nature of reality, that there is good and there is evil, that there is the realm of matter, and the denser the matter is, the more evil it becomes, and that there is the realm of spirit. In the Gnostic point of view, the entity that we've been taught to believe is God, the entity called Jehovah, or Yahweh, or Allah, if you're a Muslim, from the Gnostic point of view, this entity is in fact a demon. Yeah. He's not a god. He's an imposter. He's a sort of low-level handicrafts kind of guy who has created the earth as his particular fiefdom and created human beings upon it so that they will worship and adore him. And that the spiritual realm took pity on humanity and inserted within us a divine spark. And the purpose of Gnosticism is to allow that, through direct revelation, is to allow that divine spark to grow and get to the point where spirit can be liberated from matter again. And from the Gnostic point of view, the so-called God, Yahweh, Jehovah, is his project is to keep humanity imprisoned in matter. And in this process, he has archons, evil angels, who assist him. Often they go around disguised as human beings, who assist him in every way in keeping mankind suppressed so that we never realize the true spiritual light within ourselves. And so a great struggle goes on in the universe between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. And it's that struggle, that hypothesis, I'm not insisting that it's a fact, that hypothesis that I'm taking as the central imaginary device of my novel and that I am using to account for the events that that occur. And the events were quite extraordinary. I mean, at one level, War God is an adventure story. I think the first responsibility of a novelist is not to bore his readers, you know. You have to, his or her readers, you have to. If you're going to write a novel, it's got to be fun to read. It's got to be something that you know, the reader is going to want. Well, perhaps not fun, but compelling.
Right.
The reader wants to keep turning the pages. And my goodness, I mean, the events of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, you literally couldn't make them up. Extraordinary, unbelievable things happen. I mean, first of all, there's the disparity in numbers. The Spanish turn up on the coast of Mexico with under Cortes in February 1519, with just 490 men in 11 ships. They enter first into the Mayan area of the Yucatan, and their first dealings are with the Maya. But a little further down the road, they're going to encounter the Aztecs, and the Aztecs can put 200,000 men into the field, and they are an experienced military power. And if they catch you, they're going to take you prisoner, march you up their pyramid, and cut out your heart. So they're a very fearsome enemy to confront. And I have to say, although I detest many things that the Spanish did, and it's hard in any way to be sympathetic with their mindset, that these were courageous men. This was it took extraordinary courage to be prepared to leave everything behind, turn up on the coast of Mexico, and actually sink all your ships, which is what Cortes did. He had holes drilled in the bottom of the ships so that they sank, and then he could say to his men, "We have no choice now. There's no going back. You must either conquer. You must either conquer or die."
Right.
When you look at the disparity of military forces, it seems almost impossible to believe that the Spanish could win any victories at all. In their first battle with the Maya, before they met the Aztecs, with the Maya at a place called Potonchan on the Tabasco River in the Yucatan, they faced an army of 40,000 men, and there were 490 Spaniards. But the Spanish had a number of advantages. For them, warfare was a science. For the indigenous peoples of the America, warfare was more about taking captives in order that they could be sacrificed. And this was true of the Maya to a lesser extent as it was of the Aztecs. Secondly, the Maya and the Aztecs were Stone Age cultures. They were highly sophisticated in some ways, but at level of weaponry, they had flint and obsidian blades. So their sword would be a wooden paddle with flakes of obsidian embedded into the edges of it.
Yeah.
They had no metal weapons, and they used a kind of cotton armor, whereas the Spanish had steel armor, they had swords of Toledo steel, they had guns, they had cannon, a number of small cannon called falconets and a few larger ones called lombards, which fired that horrific weapon of mass destruction called grapeshot, tiny little balls of metal that went whistling out of the mouth of the cannon and would just mow down hundreds of men at a time. Mm. They crucially had horses, They had 16 horses. Doesn't sound like many, but horses had been extinct in the New World for 12,000 years. And the Aztecs and the Maya had no idea what horses were. So at the very point when Cortes' first battle seemed certain that his tiny infantry would be crushed by this massive army of 40,000 Maya, Cortes and his 16 cavalry turned up behind Maya lines and charged them. And that charge had a devastating effect on the Mayan army. And I think we can understand why. I mean, the ground is shaking and trembling beneath the feet of these beasts. These are huge, heavy hunters with iron-shod hooves. They mounted upon them are men in silver armor with gleaming lances and swords. They are traveling at 30 miles an hour. They smash into the Mayan army with a colossal shock. And the Maya didn't know what they were dealing with. They actually, if you look at the contemporary accounts, you find that they and the Aztecs initially thought that this was some kind of supernatural being.
Right.
That it was a mixture of a deer and a man, a hybrid creature. And they had no tactics for dealing with it. European armies had tactics, infantry had tactics for dealing with a cavalry charge, which had been developed over thousands of years. The Native American armies had no such tactics, so they were devastated by cavalry, and they were devastated as well by the use of dogs by the Spanish.
Right.
And I go into this at some length in the novel, because it's really quite gruesome but fascinating. See, both the Maya and the Aztecs, they knew about dogs. They had dogs, but they had chihuahuas. That was the maximum size of dog in right. Mexico. And the chihuahua, they reared it as a food item like we rear chickens today. So they to confront mastiffs and wolfhounds, which were also armored in steel, which had been trained to relish human flesh, was a devastating shock for both the Mayan and the Aztec army. So for these reasons, their firearms, their technology, their sheer grim determination, their military science, their cavalry, their dogs, the Spanish were able to turn what seems like fearsome and impossible odds and actually win battles that you would have expected they would be crushed in minutes. And then secondly, there's the cunning, calculating Machiavellian character of Cortes, which again in a novel I'm able to explore in much more interesting ways than I would be in non-fiction. And thirdly and crucially, and what makes the story really interesting to me, is my female characters. I have two leading female characters in the novel. For some reason, when I write novels, I feel more drawn to make my heroes or heroines women than men. Mm-hmm. And there are two Native American women who are absolutely central to my story. I tell the story through the eyes of a number of different characters. But Tozi, an Aztec witch, aged close to 15, who is just coming into her power. And she is an invented character, but the Aztecs did have witches. And just as the Spanish persecuted witches, so also the Aztecs persecuted witches. So Tozi is one character, and the other is a true historical figure, and she's a lady called Malinal. And Malinal first enters the pages of history when she is given as a slave to Cortes after he defeats the Maya at that battle at Potonchan on the Tabasco River. And she becomes an absolutely crucial figure in the conquest. In fact, Cortes was later to admit that aside from God himself, it was Malinal who gave us this conquest of Mexico. She was an absolutely brilliant woman. She spoke both Maya and Nahuatl. She very quickly learned Spanish, and she became Cortes' interpreter. And when she enters the pages of history, it's already clear, this is why I found her so fascinating, that she has a huge grudge against the Aztecs and against Moctezuma. It's never made clear why. And what I was able to do, writing this as a novel, was to give her that motive. And we first meet her and the young witch Tozi together in the fattening pen at the foot of the pyramid in Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital city, waiting to be sacrificed by Moctezuma himself. Needless to say, they escape, and Malinal goes to the coast, and there she is taken prisoner by the Maya and eventually handed on to Cortes. And what she was able to tell Cortes about, the really crucial thing, the crucial piece of intelligence she gave him, was the story of Quetzalcoatl, the bearded, white-skinned god who, according to Mexican tradition, had been a god of peace, but who was driven out in the remote past by the war god. And that a reign of terror was introduced after Quetzalcoatl was driven out. But Quetzalcoatl promised that he would return and that he would overthrow the war god. There was a prophecy that Quetzalcoatl would return, he would overthrow the war god, and he would overthrow a wicked king. And it's clear that Malinal identified initially Cortes with Quetzalcoatl and identified the wicked king as Moctezuma. And so she was able to tell Cortes about this tradition and teach him how he could exploit it. She quickly realized he was no god. He was a man. After all, he eventually became her lover and the father of her child. She quickly realized he was a man, but she taught him to exploit this myth, to play on Moctezuma's superstition, and in that way, psychologically, from very early stage, to dominate him. So there's just a fascinating sort of range of issues and problems to be explored here, and amazing characters, you know, who would just be impossible to make up. Like Malinal today in Mexico is a hate figure. Modern Mexicans detest Malinal. Mm-hmm. If you want to insult somebody in Mexico, you want to call somebody a traitor in Mexico, you call them a Malinchist. That remembers Malinal as the traitor who handed Mexico over to the Spanish. But I hope my novel's gone some way to rehabilitate her. I think she was an amazing woman. She was incredibly brave. We find her in the heart of the worst battles that the Spanish ever fought, always by Cortés's side. Other Spanish soldiers who knew her comment on her outstanding beauty and on her courage. And I think she felt that the regime of the Aztecs was so wicked and so cruel that any measures that were possible to take had to be taken to bring it down. And she used Cortés as her instrument to bring down this cruel regime of serial killers who were running Mexico. What she didn't know was that Cortés, in the long run, and the Spaniards were going to make things even worse. Yeah. But I think her mm-hmm. motives were good.
Well, it seems almost, well, it's too perfect how things line up for all of this to take place. And you know, the cream on top here is the prophecy of Quetzalcoatl, specifically in even that he arrives on the same year, 1519, and was it One Reed, I think was called, in
the,
you know?
Exactly, the year One Reed. I mean, this is the most extraordinary thing. I think many people are familiar with the Chinese calendar, and we know that in the Chinese calendar there are 12 named years. I was born in 1950, which happens to be the year of the tiger. And these 12 years in the Chinese calendar cycle around, and every 12 years the cycle renews. In the case of the Aztec calendar, there were 52 named years. And it so happened that the year in which it was prophesied that Quetzalcoatl would return was the year One Reed. And that year was 1519. And the prophecy said that Quetzalcoatl would return in ships that moved by themselves without paddles. And lo and behold, that's what the Spanish had. They had ships with sails. The image of Quetzalcoatl was always as a white-skinned, bearded individual who did not look like a Native American Indian. And again, there's been some attempt at political correctness or sort of revisionist history to airbrush this story out.
Right.
But that attempt is doomed to failure, because anybody who has traveled in Mexico, who's traveled in the Yucatan, who's gone to the Olmec site of La Venta, for example, and looked at the very ancient stone carvings that are found there and at other sites like Monte Alban. Well, there are images of people with African features at La Venta, but there are also images of people with distinctly Caucasian features, unmistakably Caucasian features, with large, fulsome beards, which you do not get in the indigenous peoples of Mexico. Yeah. And that's also true of the site of Monte Alban. So quite apart from the myths and traditions, there is physical evidence that at some remote period there were people in the Americas who did not look like Native American Indians, who did look like Caucasians. And Cortés was able to play upon that and to come into Mexico with this aura of a god around him. And he had these fearsome weapons. The gods were supposed to have a thing called fire serpents, which exploded and dismembered men at a distance. And that's exactly what the guns and cannon of the Spanish did. So in every way, he fitted the bill, And he was able to psychologically dominate Moctezuma and to play upon his fears, even though there were some amongst the Aztecs who were not so foolish and who did understand that the Spanish were a bunch of brigands and pirates who were purely there to steal from them, and who did urge Moctezuma to fight against Cortes from the very beginning. Initially, Moctezuma was very weak in his relationship with Cortes, and he actually invited, when Cortes finally got to Mexico City. You know, Mexico City in those, anybody who's been to Mexico City today could not imagine that that gigantic urban sprawl was once a huge lake. But actually it was. There was a wonderful lake there, which was called Lake Texcoco. And in the heart of that lake was an island, and Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, was built on that island. Later, after the conquest, the Spanish drained the lake, but the island still stands at the heart of what is now modern Mexico City. In those days, it was approached by causeways 6 miles long, and Cortes got to the edge of the causeways, and Moctezuma came out to meet him, and astonishingly, he was so overwhelmed and so dominated by Cortes that he invited Cortes into Mexico City, bring his Spaniards in, and bring in about 1,000 of his local auxiliaries as well, and gave them a palace at the foot of the Great Pyramid of Tenochtitlan. This happened in November 1519. Now, it's clear that Moctezuma's lieutenants were urging him at that point to massacre the Spanish, that they could easily be cut off inside Mexico City. All you needed to do was break the bridges on the causeways, and retreat from the city would be extremely difficult. But Cortes forestalled this by taking Moctezuma hostage in his own palace 4 days after he arrived in Mexico City. I mean, you know, you've got to admire the sheer balls of this man. He was really just an unbelievable chancer. And he, again and again, he kept on pulling things off. Of course, I could talk for hours about this. The story goes on endlessly. Eventually, the Spanish were driven out of Mexico City. They licked their wounds. They came back. And the final conflagration did not occur until 1521, when Mexico City at last fell to the Spanish forces in the most horrific massacre that it's possible to imagine. Really terrible, terrible events. And these were dark and terrible times. And what redeems the story for me, and what I make a big point of in the novel, is the fundamental decency, courage, and goodness of quite a number of the characters who are caught up in this event, and that their capacity for love in troubled times, and to reach out to one another and help one another, and show the light in the human spirit, even in the midst of darkness.
Well, very good. I mean, I have so much more I want to ask you about when it comes to the background of this story and tying into some other you know, things, and maybe even some of your own experiences here. But why don't we take a little break here between the segments? This is a pretty good place to take a pause. So, Graham, please give us the website for people who want to pick up a copy of your latest historical novel and everything else that you have available.
Yeah, it's war-god.com, www.war-god.com. It's also all on my website, grahamhancock.com, and the book is available in the U.S. now as a very low-cost Kindle edition, and you don't have to have a Kindle. You can download the free Kindle app. It's available for $2.99 at the moment. It may go up a little bit, but we're determined to keep the price lower than the price of a cup of coffee in the U.S., and it will be, and it's available as a paperback in the U.S. from the 31st of July. It's available as a hardback in the UK, published by Hodder and Stoughton. It's going to be available in Canada on the 13th, from the 13th of August onwards, and generally around the world. If your local bookshop doesn't have it, get them to order it, or buy it from Amazon. The links are there on war-god.com. And I would appreciate the support of my readers in this. The publishing industry wants to keep me locked into the nonfiction mode. As a nonfiction author, I'm a kind of cash cow for publishers. My nonfiction books have done well, and they actually really don't want me to write novels at all.
Oh, really?
But I'm determined to follow this path, and I believe that I have something useful to say in novels, and hopefully write a story that people can immerse themselves in and be drawn into and identify with the characters and enjoy.
Well, exactly, and it goes in line with so much more that you've written previously, and it, you know, you have the historical background to the story, and it's just kind of a deepening of as you enter in with some of the characters, you know, to go along in the story, that you get closer to it, and that's what I think, and you did very well in Entangled, and as I'm listening to it and what I've read so far, I think you do an excellent job in War God as well.
Thank you. Well, just to add, on war-god.com and on grahamhancock.com, there's 4 free chapters to read from the novel. So, you know, people don't have to go and buy it on chance. They can read some chapters and see whether they like it or not.
Very good. grahamhancock.com and war-god.com. We'll have these linked up on redicecreations.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more and continue our fascinating discussion with Graham Hancock.